You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 213 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled Human Questions and Cosmic Answers, translated by Elizabeth Marshall. This is Lecture 9, given in Dornach on the 14th of July, 1922. The lectures from last week were, in a certain sense, meant to show how in the history of the second half of the 19th century, those personalities of a more profound disposition struggled, and how the contemporary scientific mentality prevented exactly such deeper natures from finding their way into the spiritual world. When we look at the personal, as we did with Franz Brentano, at the inner struggles of the soul, at what went on spiritually within these people, then we can see much more intimately what the great struggles of the time consist of than we could if we just described them abstractly. I pointed out in the last edition of Title de Goetheanum how Franz Brentano, who starting from Catholicism, immersed himself in the ethos of science, and then, in a manner of speaking, got stuck in the physical, the earthly, and was unable to find its way back to the spiritual, can be seen alongside another personality, who, apart from a few variations, suffered the same fate. This is the figure of Nietzsche. With Brentano, we can show how, from his devout Catholicism, his truly Catholic piety, he was then gripped by the scientific view of the world, which never again let go of him, and how his whole path as a philosopher can be characterized through this. We can show something similar with Nietzsche. We can show that Nietzsche, starting out not from Catholicism, but from another way of thinking, was also held back in the physical sense world by science, and just like Brentano, was unable to rise up to the spiritual, so that his fate took a similar but different turn. Brentano immersed himself in scientific thinking in the 1860s, and we have seen how, like a great wave of destiny, breaking against him, the dogma of infallibility alienated him from the church completely. Nietzsche is a few years younger, and went through a similar development in the 70s. However, he came not from Catholicism, but from an artistic view of the world, from the kind of view that a modern person can develop, who has, in their youth, immersed themselves in Hellenism, the way of looking at the world of the ancient Greeks. And we can say that Nietzsche was as fervent in his Hellenistic way and in his artistic view of the world as was Brentano with his Catholicism. He believed to have found in Richard Wagner and his art the renewal of ancient Greek culture. And just as Brentano took part in all the rites of Catholicism and absorbed himself in all that the Catholic ritual can arouse in a human being, Nietzsche absorbed the art of Wagner, in which he believed to have found a renaissance of the way the Greeks had seen the world. So he produced his first writings, and then in the 70s he experienced the influence of natural science on his soul life. Before that, he was filled with the idea that human beings have received the great ideals from the independent sphere of the spirit, that we humans can put before our souls these great moral and religious ideals, and that through them we are able to rise above the physical human level. And with great enthusiasm, Nietzsche finds inspired words to describe how humanity was immersed in the reality of these ideals. Then, however, the scientific view washes over him, and he begins to believe that he has to immerse himself in the notion that the physical side of a human being, in the broadest sense, produces these ideals out of itself. It is shattering for him to have to give up his old belief that the ideals are independent, rooted in an independent spiritual world, and accept that they are just the results of physical processes. With all these ideals existing in his mind, Nietzsche submerges himself, in a way, in the physiological aspect of human nature. What before seemed of divine spiritual origin now seems to him only human, all too human. Before, he saw how human beings devoted themselves to the world of ideals, how through this devotion they had risen above base nature. Now, he thought he knew that the base nature of humans just strives to develop the instinct to become stronger and stronger, and that providing them with ideals only serves as a means to strengthen the inner intensity of power in human beings. In short, Nietzsche strove to declare all ideals in a sense as simulacra, produced by physiological processes in the broadest sense. However, he did not think of these physiological processes in humans as narrowly as does modern science, but he did want to view ideals as the product of physiological physical processes in the widest sense. Thus, ideals became for him something that people unable to see through them bemuse themselves with, whereas those who do see through them understand that ideals, just like common instincts, emerge from the physiological background of human beings and are only meant to reinforce and accentuate their physical nature. Of course, this is a rather radical description, but it does express the essentials which so shattered Nietzsche, namely when he thought he had discovered that even conscience can be explained by physiological means. But the natures of these two personalities were rather different. Brentano is a fine spirit, attuned to ideas and cognition. With a scientific method, he constructs, in a sense, an instrument with which he then aims to analyze human soul life, just as science dissects physical life. However, this instrument becomes blunt at exactly that point at which he tries to access spiritual life. In contrast, when Nietzsche realizes that according to science the basis of everything is physiology, or at least the consequences thereof, he constructs as an instrument not a fine analytical gauge, as does Brentano, but a hammer that is robust enough to bust out anything spiritual from the physiological body. With this instrument that is robust enough to transform morals, ideals, into something physiological, he grinds down the spiritual. He gave one of his writings the title Twilight of the Idols, or How to Philosophize with a Hammer. In a way, Brentano recoils from the spiritual. Nietzsche batters it down. Basically, someone examining modern cultural history should be able to find a profound similarity between these two personalities, despite their differences. And yet, in his latest publication, that I have already spoken to you about recently, Brentano had a short chapter on Nietzsche, wherein he thoroughly rejects him. He calls him a writer of trivial literature, a fickle flash in the pan. He compares him to Jesus and claims that Nietzsche is a caricature of Jesus. Really, we have to say how strange it is that such a remarkably fine human being as Franz Brentano has not developed an organ to enable him to empathize with what another spirit experiences, who is basically so similar to him and who suffered such a similar fate, as I have described it all to you. However, this is a contemporary phenomenon, and just shows in the examples offered how people are today. They do not live in one another, they live asunder. I have often pointed out how people pass each other by without any understanding, and how this is a social phenomenon of our times. People just go past each other, even the most dedicated seeker after truth. Everyone does this. But in such distinguished personalities, this general phenomenon of our times shows itself in meaningful symptoms. Why do people just pass each other by with no understanding? Today we are in such dire need of mutual understanding. We are in great need of someone developing the ability to enter into both Nietzsche and Brentano, or say Haeckel, or David Friedrich Strauss, and so on, so as to show how these various personalities view the world from the most diverse points of view. However, only spiritual science, with its real access to the spiritual, is able to consider what fruit a worldview develops in various personalities. And this is exactly the reason why people are not able to understand each other. they have no access to the spiritual. We have to look for the reason why Brentano was not able to build a bridge to another person, who basically suffered a fate so similar to his own, in the fact that he got stuck in the scientific approach. Only a spiritual, scientific, in-depth study can penetrate the various viewpoints. For this, however, we need profound observation, profound knowledge of human beings. What are such personalities as Brentano and Nietzsche faced with when they are deeply impressed with the scientific methods of the 19th century? Sooner or later, they will be confronted with the fact that as honest seekers after truth, they have, on the one hand, the physical world, and excellent scientific methods with which to explore this world. On the other hand, they have a spiritual world. To be as superficial as many people of today and refuse to view the spiritual world as the great contrast to the physical world was, of course, not a possibility for people like Nietzsche and Brentano. They see the physical world, they see the spiritual world, but it is impossible to build a bridge between them. They see what human beings want on the basis of their physical natures. They see the will behind the instincts and drives. They try to explain these drives and instincts based on physiology, and how, in a way, they coalesce into the will. Then, however, they notice that the spiritual world raises up ideals to which they should aspire. They notice aspiration opposite will, and between will and aspiration, they can find no bridge. Someone like Brentano becomes a psychologist, a scientist of the soul. Physiology has been more or less finalized. Now he wants to study the phenomena of the soul, and in so doing, imitate the methods of science. He is not even sure whether he has any soul phenomena, because science disputes this in a sense. Brentano was only certain that soul phenomena exist not from a scientific viewpoint, but because he was a devout Catholic for so long. This terrible dichotomy exists in the souls of these people, the spiritual world, the physical world, and no bridge between them. How to move from one to the other? The ethical ideals exist. But it is not possible to understand how the thrust of ethical ideals can take hold of human muscles, can move a person to action. Science only tells us how the muscles and the bones are moved through the laws of physics, but not how aspirations influence the movements of the muscles and bones. The fact is that basically, however perfect the scientific method, this century of science was helpless when it came to the human being. They were not able to study the human being. They could not realize that humans are threefold beings, as I have described in my book titled Riddles of the Soul. They were not able to get as far as dividing human beings up into the nerve sense being, which of course fills out the whole person, but is located primarily in the head, the rhythmic being, which again fills out the whole person, but is concentrated primarily in the organs of breathing and blood circulation, then the metabolic limb being, which is all the rest of a person. This is such a significant fact that we have to link all our other knowledge of human beings to it. Of course, we should not just say that the threefold human organism consists of head, chest, and limbs. As I have already said, humans are nerve sense beings all over, just that this is most pronounced in the head. Now, look at this head. Its structure demands our admiration. All the more when we look more deeply, when we examine closely the nerve structure of the human head. There is no reason in the world of physical phenomena for the human head, especially on the inside, to be formed as it is. Now, we have to realize what I have often spoken about here. The outer form of the human head, leaving out the base of the skull, is a replica of the cosmos. It is really a sphere. There's a diagram. The form of the head is taken from the cosmos. All the cosmic forces are at work in the body of the mother so as to create the human head in its embryonic form. If we look at this from a spiritual point of view, then the human being who exists as a soul spiritual being in the soul spiritual world before descending into physical earthly existence, first unites with cosmic forces and then embraces the forces of heredity. The actual soul spiritual human being forms themselves first from the world ether and then goes into the physical substance that the body of the mother makes available. So really, the head is made out of the cosmos, and what then descends as a being from the soul spiritual worlds onto the earth has incorporated this cosmic gestalt. Hence, nobody can understand the physical construction of the human head if they cannot explain it in this spiritual sense. The human head is a replica, a direct imprint of the spiritual. These wonderful cerebral convolutions that we can discover in the physiology of the human head, all this is a crystallized spirit, spirit in the form of matter. As part of the physical body, the human head is a direct replica of the spirit. If a sculptor wanted to depict the spirit as such, they would have to study a spiritualized human head. Of course, if they just work from models, then they will not be able to capture it. But if they work from the spiritual, then they could create a wonderful image of the innermost nature of cosmic spiritual forces. In the human head, we encounter the intuition, inspiration, imagination of the cosmic spiritual. It is as if the deity had wished to create an image of the spiritual and had thus produced the human head. This is why it is basically amusing when people seek an image of the spirit, while all the time they have the best, the most sublime, the most powerful image in their own human head. But of course, just an image, not the spirit itself. With the limb being, it is just the opposite. If you compare this to the above, then the limb being is only affiliated to the earth. It only makes sense as belonging to the earth. Only the arms are a little way above the earthly. In animals, those limbs corresponding to the arms in humans are also given over to gravity. Essentially, though the human limb being is organized in relation to earthly forces. Just as the human head is a replica of cosmic spirituality, the human limb organization shows us how the spirit is bound to earthly forces. Study, for example, the form of the human leg with the foot. If you want to understand its structure, you have to understand the forces of the earth. Just as you have to understand the highest spirituality, if you want to grasp the form of the human head, so, to understand the form of the limbs, you have to study what it is that binds human beings to the earth, what pushes us down to the earth, what causes us to be able to walk on the ground and maintain ourselves in the cosmos through gravity. You have to study all this, the whole way the earth affects a being connected to it, as is the human being. Just as you have to study the spirit to understand the human head, so you have to study the physical aspect of the earth with all its forces, so as to understand the human metabolic limb being. However, this has serious consequences. Only when we can look into the human being, when we are able to look at the human head and how, in a way, it is the crystallized world of the spirit, which is active in the whole of the cosmos, and when we can see the origins of the structuring of the human limbs in the axis and swing lines through which the earth rotates, when we comprehend dynamically how the human being is formed and structured through the effects of these forces, then we can gain insight into how the soul spiritual is at work in the human being. I would like to illustrate this with two examples. Two things which are in a sense opposed to each other play a great part in human soul life. The one is what I would call doubts, the other, belief or conviction. We could possibly find other more succinct expressions. However, you will all be able to sense that we have polar opposites in our soul lives, when on the one side we talk of doubts and on the other of convictions. Now imagine what happens when a person is caught between intensive doubts and intensive convictions. Try to imagine how suddenly something, even if it is only a specific event important to you, is thrown into doubt. It need not be a great universal truth or a cosmic riddle, just something in which you are extremely interested. Then you go to bed with these doubts. Imagine how you toss and turn, how restless you feel, how it leaves you no peace. Then try to imagine how a pleasant sense of conviction flows into you, quietens your soul, how a kind of soul warmth can pervade your whole being. In short, when you actually look without bias at these two opposing natures, you will be able to see in your soul doubt on the one hand, conviction on the other. Now, what is the difference when you look at the whole human being? The human head is a replica formed from the cosmic ether of what we were in the spiritual world. The human head is a pure replica of the most human, namely the spiritual human. Notions of doubt approach the head, but find no place in it. The head does not take them up. They have to pass through the head and down into the limb being. In the limb being, they unite with the grainy aspect of the human material being, with what permeates this being granulatively, that is, what takes on an atomic aspect. Doubts go right through the head as if it was permeable. The blood then takes up these doubts, and they are carried down to the rest of the organism, are first absorbed by the metabolism, and then transferred to the nervous system. They live in all that is atomistic in human nature, what is granular or salty. They unite especially intimately with these last. The body receives these doubts and they go through the head. Only when we understand the specific nature of the human head, and that the material of the head is not suited to doubts, because the head is a replica of truth itself, from whence we come when we descend from the spiritual to the physical earth, only then do we understand that just as light passes through transparent glass, so these doubts pass through our heads and into the other parts of the nervous system and into our metabolism. The head only absorbs these notions of doubt in as far as it is also part of our metabolism. But it guides them through its specific nerve organization and only absorbs the convictions. When they penetrate the human head, these convictions find related entities everywhere. They feel at home in the whole of the nervous system. They come to rest in the human head and flow into the rest of the body, not through the blood, but through the nervous system, which is itself in a kind of destructive process, so that in their spiritual aspect they flow directly into the rest of the human being. But primarily they settle in the head, they fill out the head. And in this head they receive the gestalt appropriate for the whole person from the spirituality of the structure of the head, including the inner form, and then they are as if intimately related to the person, as if that person would live in them, as if they were that person. We could say that in these convictions, the head of the human being forms something which is most suited to that person. If you study the human embryo, then you will see that first the head is formed, and then the rest of the organism. This is because those forces which form the rest emanate from the head. When the head absorbs convictions, then this is what happens spiritually. At first they are absorbed by the head, and the head then sends them to the rest of the human being. Just as physically, in the embryo, the rest of the body follows after the formation of the head, so the spirit of the convictions and ideas is sent out to the rest of the human being, and a human being is formed spiritually from these convictions. And there's a diagram. An inner image of the human being radiates out into the specific human being, and the convictions unite with all the warmth that flows through a person. Just as the doubts unite with all the granular, the atomistic, so the convictions unite with the warmth that flows through the body, the first link of the etheric that permeates the whole person, and do not enter further into the physical. Now try to imagine the presence of the doubtful and the convinced in human nature, and whenever you experience the beneficial effects of a conviction and the tortuous effects of doubts, you will be able to understand the truth of the matter in real life. I've often said that the spirit of language is one that works with reason, common sense. And if we attribute Zeugung, procreation, diagram on the right, to the embryo, then it is not surprising that to this structure on the left we attribute Überzeugung, conviction. We should not see this as merely accidental. These are the deeds of the genius of language, which shows more than the individual human being. I am aware that modern linguistic science sees this as nonsense, but if they would really look deeply into the weaving of the reigning genius of language, then some aspects of modern philology and linguistics would appear as nonsense. Now think of what this all means. You have now a picture of how two soul experiences, doubts and convictions, affect the physical human being. You have received an absolutely understandable bridge between the soul spiritual and the physical. You can say to yourself, here is the physical human being, and what they experience in their soul shimmers and ripples through the physical granulates in the body. Here is a skeptic. Here is a doubter. You can see in the inner structure of matter how the disbeliever vibrates throughout the soul and then the body. You see the other person whose warmth flows through their limbs, and you can see in this quiet flow of warmth the physical expression of someone devoted to belief conviction. You can see in the human being the direct physical expression of the spirit. Now you begin to understand the physical. When they analyze the human being, the modern chemist and physicist would say that they contain calcium, phosphorus, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon. But in oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon, you will never find the spiritual. Dubois Raymond is absolutely right when he says that oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon atoms are completely indifferent to how they are arranged or how they are moving. If we only see matter in the body as carbon, oxygen, and so on, then this is true. However, when we know that inside matter there is something which is receptive for the spirit in various ways, and which in the head is a direct replica of spiritual being, quiddity, and in the rest of the human being is united with the earth, so that the earth holds on to what passes through the head as doubts, then it is no longer possible to think that in our brains there are a number of carbon atoms, nitrogen atoms, and so on, regardless of the nature of their arrangement or of their movements. We can see that matter is not indifferent to whether a stream of warmth flows through it or whether there is a salt process, so that the body then tends to produce a grainy structure. These are two antithetical states which express themselves in the body but which originate in the spiritual. The fact is that we did not get materialism in the 19th century because humanity had never known the spirit. That most materialistic age knew the spirit in its most clarified form. All the earlier ages never knew the spirit in its purest form because in the images of the spirit that they developed, there was always something material mixed in. Purely spiritual ideas were only first developed in the scientific age. However, what the scientific age had to disregard is precisely the actual knowledge of matter, of spirit in matter. Materialism has brought us to a lesser knowledge of material existence in the world. The loss of insight into the weaving of the spiritual in the material through ignorance of the way matter functions. By not knowing how the spirit works creatively, people began to imagine the spirit more and more abstractly. Thus, aspiration to ethical ideals became something you could not mention, because it could not even float around in space, having not a grain of materiality. It had just ceased to exist. Trying to catch a glimpse of it was like trying to breathe in an element which is not available. The human beings of the 19th century are like people trying to breathe by means of a bicycle pump. When they try to grasp ethical ideals, they are not there. They long for them, but they are not there, because people refuse to develop an idea of how the soul spiritual works in the physical body. This is why they developed all those curious theories about the interplay of the physical with the soul spiritual. These were all just fabrications, whereas real knowledge can only be gained by following the facts exactly. When we realize how doubts and convictions flow through the body, then we are able to recognize in the world what we have already noticed in the human being. In the world, we have the sphere of material functioning. We see, for example, how in the world outside, matter has to take on a granular formation, how it crystallizes. Now, if we have realized how in us doubts unite with the granular in our organism, then we can recognize doubts in the outside world. For example, we look at the mountain. There's a diagram, which is formed from granular rock. At the same time, we can see how the same thing permeates the mountain that we know from ourselves as doubts. And we get to know the creative power of doubt. Doubts in us make us granular, because we are humans and not nature. Doubts outside in nature create the appropriate thing. When what works outside in nature permeates us, then it creates something inappropriate. By walking on rocky ground, you are walking on the physical formation of what God has sent out as doubts, so that the world can become granular. And in turn, when you study your convictions or beliefs steeped in warmth, then you find yourself in what is creatively coming into being. So that when you consider that basically in warmth we can find the source of cosmic creative forces, then you will find that what is working through warm matter is cosmic conviction, cosmic belief. If you first truly learn to recognize these things in yourself, then you will be able to evaluate the active agents outside in the cosmos. When you can recognize all that crumbles away in the outside world, showing us the first signs of the decaying of our earth in the universe that lies ahead of us, as being the emanation of cosmic doubts, then you can understand much of cosmic existence. And conversely, when you recognize conviction, belief in the cosmic, then you can better understand the creative force. These are just examples through which I wanted to indicate how we first have to get to know the human being so as to have a chance of understanding cosmic existence. Now you see, Brentano studied scientific methods in the 60s, Nietzsche in the 70s. This research found that carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, some sulfur, and so on, were in the brain. There was no sign of the spirit. And when they used the methods which came up with these results on the spirit, of course they could only arrive at either spiritual helplessness, as did Brentano, or at complete spiritual demoralization, as did Nietzsche, who was more of a will person. But both suffered the fate of not being able to go from the physical to the spiritual, because they could not find the spiritual in the physical, and so could not experience the spirit as powerful enough to create the physical out of itself. Thus, such minds were faced with a physical nature which really had no meaning, as it contained no spirit, and with a spiritual nature that had no power, no strength. This is the fate of two of the most significant minds of the second half of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. They were faced with matter without meaning, spirit without potency. Historians have spoken of ideas in history. This is also spirit without power. You cannot make of these ideas cultural instruments which influence civilization or through which historical events take place. Abstract ideas are impotent, spirit without power. On the other hand, we have nature, which they only studied as unspiritualized matter, matter without meaning. We will never find the bridge when we have the one absurdity, matter without meaning, and the other absurdity, spirit without power. Only when we find power in the spirit, in conviction, which causes strength and warmth to flow through the body, because this is the way human beings are organized. When we find strength in doubt to propel it through the head and downward, because it has no affinity with the head, to soften up the rest of the human being so that it tends toward the granular. Only then, when we find power in the spirit to both dissolve the granular through warmth, as well as to create it in the salt process, then we will find matter with meaning, because the spirit works so powerfully that what we perceive as matter becomes meaningful. Then we have matter with meaning and spirit with potency. This is what such minds as Brentano and Nietzsche reveal to us in their tragic fates and their personalities. The end of Lecture 9.